Elizabeth Kubler-Ross originally invented the five stages of grief as a study of death. She interviewed several people, actually hundreds of people, in terminal wards of different hospitals and discussed what they were feeling, what they were going through, knowing that their time here was short. Eventually, these developed into not just stages of someone processing their own death, but stages of us processing other tiny deaths and big deaths that can happen throughout our life. One of her students, David Kessler, eventually proposed a sixth stage of grief, making meaning. You can probably understand why I have a bit of interest in this topic. Kessler suggests that making meaning out of grief is one of the most profound ways that we can reach acceptance when these things happen to us. But what does it mean when we lose a sibling? Annie Sclaver-Orenstein is an author and a researcher and wrote a book called Always a Sibling in response to losing her eldest brother. Having a sibling is a profound experience. It can offer us a mirror into who we really are and were. It taps directly into our inner child, especially as an adult when we're back in these situations with our siblings and are reminded of all of the shared experiences that have made us who we were. And the lack of a shared experience can also provide some deep reflection and inflection points to understand why we are the way we are. Always a Sibling is a profound tale and account of the many ways that siblingship impacts us, both in life and in death, through estrangement or extremely close relationship. And I am so excited to be discussing this book with Annie Sclaver-Orenstein today. Hey y'all, I'm Reese, and welcome to Making Meaning. Before we jump into the interview, I did want to say if this is your first time here at the Cohere Collective, welcome so very much. We are so glad that you are here. If this is your first time, please subscribe wherever you are listening or watching and leave us a review, a rating, a comment, and I would love to give you a shout out. So if you leave a comment, a review in a future episode, you may be shouted out. So do it. Let me know what you think about the episode. Of course, a brief content warning before jumping in. This episode discusses grief, death, sibling relationships, and families of origin and trauma that can be associated with that. If any of those topics are going to be especially upsetting to you, I recommend logging off and joining us for a future episode. I believe that is all I have. So with all of that being said, let's take a deep breath. And get started. Annie, thank you so much for joining me this morning. I am so looking forward to this conversation. I am a sibling myself, and so I deeply enjoyed your book, Always a Sibling. So thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. Thank you for reading it and for having me on.
Absolutely. Well, I'm going to kick things off with the same question I always do just to set the tone for our podcast. And that is, what is one thing you're grateful for right now?
Right now, I am very grateful for cousins. It's the first thing that comes to mind. When my oldest brother died, which I'm, obviously we'll talk about, growing up, I had a lot of cousins, big boisterous family functions. And when my brother died, I worried that that was gone. The potential of that was gone. And my surviving brother has 4 kids and I have 2 kids, and a lot of our, other cousins have, really gotten ever closer in our lives, and their kids are our kids' cousins. And this past weekend, my kids got to hang out with a bunch of their cousins and have a lot of fun. And looking at them and watching them made me very happy, because it was something that I wasn't sure I was going to be able to give them. And so this morning I woke up feeling especially thankful for that.
That's beautiful. There is something really unique about family connection, and I'm a big believer in chosen family, and that you choose your blood family the same way you can choose your non-biological family, right? And so that choice that you've made to give your kids that relationship is really special and unique. But let's dig in a little bit more to your story. The second question I always ask my guests is, what is your story? I find that this is a really nice way to kind of crack open the conversation, and I would just love to hear all about Annie.
Sure thing. So I grew up with two older brothers and two parents, and a very, I would say, like a very Leave It to Beaver type of growing up, right? My brothers and I were very close. My parents, you know, had a very, still do, but a very beautiful marriage, you know, always clearly in love and happy. And I will say at one point, like maybe around middle school, I started to think like, this can't be real forever. As you know, friends, parents started to get divorced, and I started to learn more about the realities of the world and be a little less sheltered. My little Leave It to Beaver situation felt like, you know, I think I started to feel like I was waiting for the shoe to drop. Like, nothing is this easy, this good, this whatever. There was a lot of catastrophizing on my side. That's what a therapist taught me.
Oh, yes. We are familiar with catastrophizing over here.
I was like, there's a name. But it really was a beautiful childhood and you know, growing up. And in 1999, I want to say it was 1999 or early 2000, my eldest brother joined the Army Reserves when he was going back to school for grad school. And he was always very into government policy, international affairs. That's what he was going to school for. And he felt like, you know, the military had access to all of these things that civilian organizations didn't. And his theory was, if he wanted to go out and help and provide international aid and support and all of this stuff, well, the military is a perfect vehicle for that, because they have tons of resources and funds and money and right. All of that. Then 9/11 happened, and he was in the reserves, and we all panicked, you know, what is about to happen. And things were pretty calm for a while. He was deployed for the first time in 2006. And at that point, he was deployed to the Horn of Africa. And it was very much what he thought he would be able to do with the military. They were bringing clean water to communities in northern Uganda and the Sudanese border. And in fact, when he got home, he formed a nonprofit to continue that work. And it really felt like, this is it. Like, I'm using the military's resource to bring clean water to these communities. He was called up again on a stop loss order in 2009, and this time to Afghanistan. And, you know, what we've learned since then was, I think it was not the same kind of, experience that he had, you know, when he was deployed the first time. And he was deployed in July of 2009, and on October 2nd of 2009, when he was on foot patrol, they were out presumably to go meet a community leader, and instead they were met by a suicide bomber, and he was killed instantly. And even though I had spent the last 10, 15 years thinking something bad is going to happen to our family. And even though I was convinced that he was not going to be okay. I was terrified that he was not going to come home. And yet when it happened, I felt like this isn't right. This isn't what was supposed to happen. And it really, you know, shook all of us as it does for everyone. And so that was almost 15 years ago, which is wild to imagine. I was 25 at the time, and there were no resources that felt specific to sibling loss. I have a very vivid memory of going into a huge bookstore in New York City and going to the grief section and looking for something that could help me. And there was nothing there. There were books on losing parents and spouses and children and pets. And there was nothing about siblings. And I took that to mean that my loss didn't matter. Siblings didn't need these resources because they weren't grieving. You know, that I was being dramatic. I was the problem. and I struggled with that. I mean, I struggled with the loss a lot. And I kind of continued on my path and became a professional researcher. I worked in the toy industry for a while, and I worked at agencies for a while. And the last about 6 years I've been working in tech, and I always just kind of kept doing my thing. And when we were approaching the 10-year anniversary of Ben's death, I wanted to do something. I wanted to capture the stories about him that I didn't know, because I was 8 years younger than him. So there was, you know, he told me a lot. He was very open, but I knew I didn't know everything. And I wanted to collect those memories, and I wanted to have that kind of record of him. And over time, what started as this, you know, series of interviews of people who knew him to try to capture his story, it evolved into this book that is, you know, in many ways, I think the book that I needed when I was 25 and I was standing in that bookstore, and the book I needed again when I was 30, and then probably every year since then. You know, it's not only about that first initial loss. But that's really what it turned into. It went from being a project about Ben to a project informed by Ben in many ways, and kind of a love letter to the sibling relationship, and hopefully a source of support to other people who are in a similar place, who aren't feeling seen or whose grief isn't being acknowledged.
I think that one of the most beautiful pieces that we see this reflected in the book is the subtitle, The Forgotten Mourner's Guide, right? That you took this experience that you had of walking into this bookstore and feeling forgotten by the world of grief. And you were able to give a voice to that, to remember all of the mourners so that they don't feel forgotten in the future. And I just have to remark on, you know, that process of turning pain into purpose is something that is so integral to the human experience. So thank you for doing that. Would you concur that is kind of what this has evolved into, that it is this pain to purpose journey, or how would you categorize that?
I do think so. I think it's, my brother loved, this is a long way to say yes, but hopefully a beautiful one. My brother kept a lot of journals, and he loved quotes. song lyrics, quotes, all of it. And he would, you know, if he saw a good quote, he would just immediately write it down. And in going through, you know, his stuff, I found a lot of these pieces of paper, you know, in his handwriting where he just wrote, you know, a quote on it. And I have one that's framed, that's behind me, that says, "If you don't like the way the world is, you change it. You have an obligation to change it. You just do it one step at a time." And I think I didn't realize that's what I was doing, because the project shifted kind of over time, and I almost didn't, I don't think I really stopped to think about the purpose piece, or the, you know, the meaning piece so much. And I found that after I was already working on it, and I realized that's what I was doing. And I think you know, that was very much always his ethos in life. And so I knew that was something that would resonate with him. But I think it very much is, you know, I had this horrible, painful experience, you know, certainly the worst thing that's ever happened to me. And I saw something that was broken. And there are very few things you can fix in the world of grief. You can't fix your grief. You can't fix someone else's grief. You can't bring your person back. You know, you can't. And for a long time, that's what I focused on, was, you know, well, if I can't bring him back, then nothing else matters, because nothing's going to bring him back. So like, what's the point? And I think I somehow found myself, you know, over 10 years later, coming back to one thing that I could fix. And that did, I think, give me a lot of purpose and a lot of, it gave me a gift in a lot of ways, because it, the writing of the book helped in my own grief, and it helped me process, and it helped me, you know, move forward in a lot of ways where I had been stuck.
That's really beautiful. And I think it leads perfectly into one of the topics that I wanted to discuss, which is, of course, the stages of grief that all of us pretty much have heard. It's very big in the zeitgeist and our kind of pop psychology. And Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, as you write in the book, started research about these five stages of grief. And then one of her students, David Kessler, introduced the sixth stage, which is finding meaning. Mm-hmm. And I remember I learned about that a little bit ago, and I was like, what an interesting concept. Because of course the podcast is called Making Meaning. And for that to be tied into something like grief, I've really been reflecting on that a lot. Can you talk a little bit about this finding meaning piece of grief and how it has helped you with that process, and why you think that that was added into this already established kind of system that we have for grief?
Yeah, I think I will try not to go off too hard, but I think
go off as hard as you want. This is the space for it.
In the five stages, they were originally developed as the five stages of like grieving your own death. Her research was with kind of death and dying. And they weren't meant to be stages of grief for those of us who are mourning the loss of someone else. And I think it becomes kind of dangerous, honestly. I was trying to decide if dangerous is too strong a word, but I don't think it is. Because what happens is a lot of people think they're doing it wrong. If they're not hitting those five stages in order and they're not making progress, then they think they're grieving wrong. And that's just not true. There's no wrong way to grieve. There are a lot of different ways to grieve. And there's a whole chapter in the book where I go through the 15 commonly recognized forms of grief. And you can experience multiple, which means, you know, I'm out of practice with my math, but nearly infinite possibility of combinations of types of grief you can experience at the same time, in sequence, you know, all of this. And so I think the stages are can be very harmful for some people, because they end up holding themselves and others to an unrealistic standard or expectation. That said, I do agree that finding meaning is a really important piece of this. And I think what it comes down to, you know, I initially was very resistant to that idea because there is nothing that could get me angry or get my blood pressure up faster than someone saying everything happens for a reason. Some things don't. Some things happen and there's no good reason, right? Yeah. And saying that everything happens for a reason can be very diminishing of someone's loss and experience, right? And so when I thought about the idea of meaning, I would think about it like, well, let's give a purpose to why this happened, right? Everything happens for a reason and meaning is that reason. So let's figure out why this happened. And I think that was my bad, right? That was my misunderstanding. I don't think that's anyone's expectation. I think what it comes down to is, and the way I think about it is, you have to find an outlet. You have to find some way to channel everything. And there's a very beautiful book called Grief is Love, written by Marissa Renee Lee. And it's just beautiful. It's so beautiful. And in it, she has a line where she says that grief is unrequited, unconditional love, which is just the most perfect way to describe grief, because I will always love my brother unconditionally and it will always be unrequited, right? And the way I think about making meaning is, I have all of this unconditional love, and where can I put it? Can I channel it somewhere? How can I get that love back out into the universe instead of just letting it eat me alive because it is unrequited and it is, you know, a torture to turn it around inside of me day after day. And so when it comes to making meaning, the way I understand it and the way that I think of it is, I have this unconditional amount of love for my brother, and I can't show it to him in the same way I could show it to him the first 25 years of my life. But I hopefully have, you know, 75 years beyond that. So are there other ways that I can show that love and channel that love? And I think that's really what making meaning ultimately is all about, is finding an avenue for that love. And it could change and it can morph over time. But I think that's really the essence of it.
That is so beautiful. And I think something really poignant about what you said is that if you keep it in, it almost turns malignant, right? That even though love is this pure thing, it wants to be given freely. It doesn't want to be held back. Mm-hmm. And when you do so, you're kind of putting these barriers on something unconditional, limitless, infinite. Mm-hmm. And that inherently changes what it is, because it just sounds like I just completely agree that love is inherently a gift. And once it is no longer a gift, can it really be love?
Yeah. And I think that I didn't really realize this until the book came out, because working on the book, you know, was done very much in isolation, as writing is, right?
Right.
And I didn't show it to very many people beyond, you know, my agent and editor and husband, partly because I didn't want to be swayed by other people's opinions and all of that. I had my own reasons, but so I worked on it very much alone. I was pouring out love into this book. And it wasn't until it came out that the love started to come back to me, and I didn't realize that would happen or what that would feel like. But what I have realized, just, you know, the book came out less than a month ago as of our recording. And what I didn't anticipate was the feeling of that love coming back, because you kind of get used to the unrequited part of it, right? As torturous as it is. But every time I hear that I've helped someone, you know, or someone reaches out to say thank you, or that something resonated, or that they feel seen, or whatever it is, that love is coming back and being shown to me. And it's incredible. And it, I think, is, you know, a part of that is that if you hold that unrequited, you know, if you hold that unconditional love in, then no one can give it back to you. No one can project it back to you. And I would give up all of it to just have my brother here and be able to pick up the phone and call him, but I can't. Right. And so, you know, I think this is a really nice plan B, right? It's kind of the best I can hope for, given the reality that we're living in. And I didn't expect that unrequited love to feel, I didn't expect to feel it coming back to the extent that I have. And it's been really, really beautiful experience.
It is almost as though once you are allowed to give that love freely to someone else, it also opens up this permission to give it to yourself, to also accept it.
That's a very good point.
Thank you. One thing that I also wanted to touch on is the relationship between siblingship and inner child work. One thing that you mention in the book is that the reason why sibling relationships are so complex and nuanced, but also important, is whether you're close with a sibling or not, that is someone who directly experienced the same like linear timeline of your personal evolution as you did. And that person will always be this encapsulation of the like symbol of your inner child. Can you talk to me a little bit about that and how siblingship can change our own personal relationship with ourselves?
Yeah. So I think, you know, siblings, there are a lot of people in our lives who know who we are, right? And people who can understand us on a really deep level, you know, our partners, our best friends. But the difference with our siblings is that they know who we are, but they also know why we are. They know why we do those weird little things that we do and why we have those quirks, and they can remember, you know, when this first thing happened. And I think that's something that we often don't realize how important that is. Sometimes we don't know why we do the thing we do until our sibling is like, oh yeah, well, you do that because dad used to always do that, or whoever used to always do that, you know? You know, I think especially when you're the younger sibling, like I am, you know, Ben was 8 years older than me. So his memory of my childhood was more clear than my own memory of my childhood. I don't remember being 2 years old, but he was 10. He remembers me being 2 years old. Wow. And so he could fill in the gaps in my memory. And siblings spend more time, on average, siblings spend more time together, alone together, than with their parents. And I think about that with my own children, and it's true, right? After school, they're with a sitter. I'm still working. Right now, they're at summer camp, and they're at the same camp. And they're, you know, they share a room. They hang out at night after, you know, we close the door. They inevitably spend more time together than they do with me. And so there's a lot of stuff they know about each other that I don't know about either of them. And a lot of things they understand about each other. And we get so used to that because it's kind of the default that we don't realize how important it is to have someone that you don't have to explain yourself to. You don't have to give a disclaimer. You don't have to give context. They just know and understand. And that's a very hard person to lose. And you often don't realize it until they're gone that, oh, that was, you know, that was something that, that didn't exist other with other people or in other relationships in my life. And you know, they're also supposed to be our longest relationship. It begins before we meet our partners, and usually it survives beyond the death of our parents. And so because of that, losing them, especially, you know, earlier, younger, is feels like it's out of the natural order of things, and you don't know how to exist without them. You've never existed in a world without them. It's very common after losing a sibling for people to think that they are going to die. And it doesn't matter how their sibling died. It doesn't matter if it was, you know, you'd think, okay, if it was an accident, that could happen to anyone. Or maybe if it was something genetic, you'd feel more. But the cause of death doesn't matter. The kind of logic in our lizard brains is we live for as long, this is our, you know, we are born together, we get old together. So if that person has died, I too am going to die now. And it's something that I heard in the interviews that I conducted, but it's also something that's, you know, captured in academic literature. It's this incredible phenomenon of just like, even if you weren't close, you just expect to live the same amount of time. So if they're gone, you're like, well, shit, I guess it's my time too. And it's such a unique thing, but they're just, you know, all of these elements of siblings, it doesn't even matter if you were close to them, right? Maybe all the time you spent together as a kid was pretty traumatic. And maybe they were not a good sibling to you. That's still going to have an impact. That still is, you know, I'm sure is a significant factor in who you are. We create our own identities relative to that of our siblings, whether it's that we want to be like them or we want to be as different from them as humanly possible.
Wow, that is really, really profound. And as someone who I'm a younger sister and I'm not the closest with my sibling, and what you just said was we create our identities in relationship to our siblings. And yes, absolutely. And as someone who it's like I am a living example of exactly what you're talking about, that you don't have to be close to them. You could have a very difficult relationship to them, and they are still a goalpost in your life. That is that measuring stick of where you are, where you've come from, where you're going. And to lose that is unmooring, regardless of your relationship to the goalpost itself. And it's that unsettledness that is so traumatizing about losing that person.
Yeah. And I think when you aren't close, it's also very difficult in grief because people say, oh, well, you weren't close, were you? Well, doesn't really matter, you know? And so I think that kind of gets even more diminished. And also for some people that I spoke to, some folks in the research, they weren't close, but they assumed that relationship would always exist. And so they thought, well, there are opportunities, you know, just because we're not close now doesn't mean that we won't get close in the future, especially if a loss is around adolescence and, you know, they're teens and people are excited. Well, when we're adults, we're going to get along. And, you know, once we're out of the house, we'll be friends or whatever it is. But you always think you have more time with your sibling. And so a lot of people were mourning the relationship they never got to have, or the fact that, you know, it closed the door on any possibility of having a, you know, healthy and you know, reciprocal sibling relationship, even if they hadn't had one to date. You know, a lot of people still hold out hope, and yeah, that is gone as well.
Wow. Yeah. And I think it's Emily Dickinson that has the quote, "Hope is the thing with feathers." Like, it is this lifting feeling, and to be unmoored in that way, and then to also lose something that is integral to your future that you perhaps imagine, would also feel deflating. I want to continue talking about this almost idea of guilt that I think we're maybe kind of treading around a little bit. Because of course, with any death, you know, survivor's guilt is absolutely a thing. But I think especially with being young and having a relationship with someone when you're young and knowing that their time was cut short, that survivor's guilt, I would imagine, please share with me since I am absolutely not an expert on this, would perhaps increase, but also the guilt of perhaps not having acted sooner. You have a really beautiful section in the book about the shoulds that plague us after death happens. And I just have to imagine I've been lucky to only lose a few people in my life. And even then those shoulds pop up. But with someone this close, I would have to imagine that there are so many. So I would love to hear a little bit more about the shoulds and the guilt that accompany this experience.
Yeah. In the book, I call these the dreaded shoulds. And it's true. There is a tremendous amount of survivor's grief. Again, you're supposed to live for the same amount of time, and now they're gone and you're still here. And there's a lot of, you know, why me? Why them? The survivor's guilt, the shoulds, I found in my research often had a lot to do with the cause of death, at least initially. So when there was, I'll give a very straightforward example. If there was illness involved, and especially if there was some kind of genetic illness and you are biological siblings, that's just like Russian roulette, right? They got it and I didn't, but there's no reason why. And you're, you know, with illness, you witness their suffering, you witness their illness, and you're seeing all this happening thinking, I have the exact same genetic makeup, and yet they got this thing and I didn't. And that was a very strong, you know, survivor's guilt. That's kind of the, you know, why them? Why not me? When the death was kind of related to addiction or mental health, you know, if suicide or overdose or anything like that was involved, there's often a lot that led up to that. Right. Struggle with drugs, struggle with mental health. And there's often feelings of I should have done more. I should have, you know, even for siblings who did everything. And I talked to quite a few of those who, you know, were there for every rehab stay, who took care of their siblings, you know, financially and emotionally and did everything, like took on parent roles, even for those people. There was a feeling of I should have done more. And again, an element of like, it could have been me, right? These are diseases and we have the same genetic makeup. Like that could have been me. And I think that feeling of like, I could have done more existed even when logically you couldn't have done more.
Right.
And I wrote about this in the book. I felt a tremendous amount of grief because I was always convinced that this deployment was not going to end well. And so I held all of this guilt that I didn't try harder to convince him to stay, even though I tried very hard to convince him to stay. And it wasn't, you know, I felt like what I did wasn't enough. And when I was writing the book and I was writing this section, I reached out to my brother Sam and said, you know, do you feel a lot of guilt? And he said, guilt about what? And I was like, that we couldn't convince Ben to stay, that we didn't do more to convince him to stay. And he was almost confused by my question. And he was like, we couldn't have convinced him to stay. Like,
wow.
In his mind, it was so far out of the realm. It was so far out of our control. And the way he explained it to me, he said, you know, we all know the hero's journey. When the hero is called to adventure, he has to go. And I would never have gone. This is my brother saying it. I would never have gone. I would have done everything in my power to get out of that deployment.
Right.
But Ben was always going to go. He was the hero on the journey. And I never felt guilty. And I was shocked. I also was like, why didn't I ask you this 10 years ago? Like that would have really helped, you know, but I think he was right. But that logic would have never crossed my mind, you know, but all of the, you know, there are also shoulds around, we should have had more time together. You know, we should have gotten old together. You know, a lot of the shoulds kind of stem from like this anger of feeling like you were robbed of something, but they're very pervasive, and they can really muddle the way we think about the situation and our part in it. And I think we put ourselves under kind of unrealistic expectations in a lot of ways. You know, shoulds come from this place of feeling like we have more control than we really do. But thinking we don't have control is terrifying.
Yeah. Yeah. Boy, is it. One thing that you were talking about that this wasn't even a part of my preparation, but I'm so fascinated by hearing about your relationship with your brother, Sam. You said you are the youngest of the three of you, yes?
Mm-hmm.
How, with Ben being the oldest, 8 years older than you, and then Sam, of course, being in between, how has your relationship with Sam shifted and changed in your siblingship, having gone through this shared experience of losing Ben, but also, I have to imagine, complete unique experience, because you're both still individual people that experienced Ben and your family in different ways, but you still have that goalpost in Sam that probably understands this more than anyone else can.
Mm-hmm.
How has that relationship shifted and changed and maybe helped or made more complicated your grieving process?
I think Sam and I are very, very close. And I like to think we would be very close regardless. But I obviously don't know that. But I will say, you know, in the beginning, so Ben was the big brother that you call with your problems if you really want to like explore them. You know, you really want to dissect the situation and like really get into it. And Sam was the brother you would call if you want to be distracted from your problems and, you know, just like mood change. And he would talk about stuff if you wanted to, but he didn't necessarily like, that just wasn't his thing.
Right.
I don't know how else to describe it. It's not his personality. And I think after Ben died, we didn't necessarily talk explicitly about it all the time, but we found ways to be together all the time. We both lived in Brooklyn, and we would, you know, I would just stop by the apartment a lot. He worked on TV shows, and if they were filming anywhere near where he knew I was in the city, he would call me and say, "I'm 5 blocks away, come visit set," and I would show up. So we just kind of showed up for each other a lot and didn't necessarily dissect our feelings on the matter, but were like physically together to the point of like standing while hugging each other, you know, like really kind of clinging on to it. When I started working on the book, we started talking more and more about these things because I would often reach out and say, like, you know, those questions like, "Do you feel guilty?" And I would just trigger him right in the middle of the day, like a good
Oh,
little
I
sister.
just lost you for a quick second.
Oh, you
Oh,
hear me?
there you are. Okay, I
Okay.
lost you for a quick second. The last I heard was when you started working on the book, you would reach out with some questions.
Okay.
If we can go
Yes.
back to right there, that would be perfect.
Yes. So I would trigger him in the middle of the day, like a good little sister does, and send him these
That's
text
right.
messages.
That's right.
And I think it opened up a lot for us because we started talking about it a lot more. And we started talking about him a lot more. And it's interesting because in reading Ben's diaries, which I did much later, there's an entry where he talks about, we're visiting him at study abroad, and he talks about his relationship with Sam and his relationship with me and how they're different. And I think it was very emblematic of what we both lost. You know, I think he really captured the essence of what we both struggled with, you know, because of what the relationship was. And it was different, but it was very close for all of us. And I don't think we can fill that void for each other, but we don't really try to. You know, I don't try to act like the big brother that he lost, you know, and he has admitted he tried to take on the role of big brother, of oldest for some amount of time, but he now feels that he is solidly back as the middle child. And so I think we have, we're not trying to be anything that we're not for each other, but we are always there for each other. And, you know, in how things have changed, I think we weren't always the best at like talking all of the time because you just assume there will always be time. And now, you know, a few times a week, we call or text each other just to say, "I love you." And I don't know that we would be doing that otherwise. You know, if Ben was still here, I don't know that we would be doing that. And I'm glad that we do.
Absolutely. I think one thing about what you're talking about in not having to fill that role or necessarily even talk about it, but having a shared experience with someone and then just sharing the space, like it goes back to what you were saying at the very beginning of our conversation about a sibling, that it's just someone who sees without you having to expend the energy to have them see. They just bear witness naturally because there's really no way that they can't. Because they're right there beside you. And I think that having someone see what you're going through so transparently is really healing in and of itself. That I mean, you're not alone in it, is typical or cliche that that may sound like, that is truly deeply meaningful. One thing I also wanted to make sure we talked about was this idea with siblings and grief. In reading your book, I was thinking a lot about how we can grieve things that maybe haven't passed on, and these griefs that we can have throughout our life. And that was actually one thing that was really powerful for me about the book, was this idea of grieving perhaps hope of a specific relationship with my brother, or grieving the family dynamic that I won't have, right? That these are still griefs related to my siblingship, and yet my brother is still here. I would love to hear your thoughts about that and how your book could also support people going through that too.
Yeah, I think, so my understanding, and hopefully I'm not using this term wrong, but that's kind of known as an ambiguous loss or ambiguous grief when you're grieving something that's still alive or still there, you know, and that happens a lot with things like estrangement. And I think such a good question, because when I started writing the book and I was doing these interviews, a few people reached out and said, you know, my brother, you know, hasn't died, but we're estranged. Is that the kind of loss that you're talking about? And I would say, no, you know, that's a different experience, a different book. But what I've heard since the book came out is that it has been helpful for people in those situations, you know, in part because it helps people understand why they're grieving something, especially if you were never that close. You know, a lot of people are almost confused at like, why am I upset? We were never close. I don't even like this person very much, right? Like, maybe it's my choice that we're estranged, and yet I still feel like I'm grieving. And I think there's a false perception that we only grieve people that we had a wonderful relationship with, which is not true. We grieve imperfect people, and we grieve imperfect relationships, perhaps even more. And I think acknowledging what you have lost and you know, the situation that you're in, and coming to that like acceptance of it, is really important for any type of grief. And, you know, really thinking through, do I want to make changes, or is this the reality that I need to accept? And I don't know, you know, it's something that I haven't experienced. And so it's like a harder thing to kind of understand, but I have heard from some people who have read the book, you know, I've reached out to my surviving sibling, and we've had more conversations since reading your book than we ever had before, you know, or things like that, where it either spurs someone to reach out and rekindle those relationships, or to understand, okay, at least I understand why I'm grieving. I understand why I'm so upset, even if it's not healthy for me to have a relationship with this person, and I'm going to continue to not have a relationship with this person, but at least I can acknowledge and understand where this grief feeling is coming from, because otherwise you're like, what am I so sad about? Like, this person isn't good for me. I don't want them in my life. So why am I sad? I think especially those pieces in the book that talk about, you know, the childhood connection and those elements of it help explain that feeling a little bit, so that you can at least understand where it's coming from.
Yeah. I think one of the pieces in the book around this that was so poignant to me was when you discussed complicated grief. Mm-hmm. And I believe it was a quote you pulled from someone else. Please correct me if I'm wrong, but it was talking about how complicated grief is relentless. And because of that, it can almost be more difficult to hold, because there's all these layers and wrinkles. And of course, any type of grief is layered and wrinkled and complicated. But I think that confusion really makes it so difficult to process, right? Until we have an understanding. I don't know if there's really a question embedded in there, but I would love to hear more about complicated grief and how that relates to this.
Yeah. So complicated grief is relentless, and it is prolonged. It's now known as it's undergoing a rebrand, but it's now kind of known as prolonged grief disorder. And it's grief that is relentless, that is, you're almost stuck. There's a preoccupation with the loss, sometimes with the cause of death. There's a very strong yearning for the person, and kind of everything amplified compared to like a resilient grief, where you see more forward movement in the healing process and in the kind of acceptance process. And so complicated grief is, I suffered from complicated grief for many years after Ben died. And it was as if, you know, as if every day you're getting the news for the first time and you're trying to understand it. And you're very fixated on all of the elements of it. And it can often lead to panic attacks, nightmares, you know, physical symptoms, you know, having cortisol levels up for a long time is not good for us. And so it can often kind of even manifest in some of those physical ways. But it is like feeling stuck. And I remember people talking about moving through grief and not understanding what they were talking about, you know, because even 5 years out, it was like, but I don't get what you mean. Like, it feels the same as it
I'm
did.
In quicksand. I'm not moving forward.
Right. Yeah. And I think because I didn't know anyone else who had lost a sibling, and I wasn't really talking to Sam about this kind of element of it. And so I just chalked it up to people don't understand what it's like. You know, it's not the same as losing a grandparent. People just don't get it. Whereas honestly, my therapist should have perhaps pointed it out at the time. That would have been helpful. But I think I just thought, well, they don't get it, and that's why they're not experiencing this, and I am. When really, you know, what I was experiencing was this prolonged grief disorder, and there are a lot of ways to help, you know, and that is one of the types of grief where professional help and therapy and counseling is really strongly recommended, because it's not something that you can really dig yourself out of by yourself.
Right. Yeah. I think, interestingly, in losing, one thing that I'm hearing is a theme throughout all of this is that in losing a piece of your community, it's also a reminder to return back to that community, and that in connection, you can kind of not bring back, not experience the same relationship or feeling, but commemorate in a way, remember again that feeling of connection, which I think is really meaningful. And I want to ask a little bit more about this making meaning piece as we come to the ending-ish of our conversation. I think it's also interesting. I have several friends who are only children, and many of them are like, I just so wish I had a sibling. I so wish I had a sibling. And I always tell them, I'm like, it's hard. It's really hard. And when you're young and you get mad at your siblings, you wish you were an only child. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of want to ask about how having that sibling relationship changes the way we approach the meaning of our lives, and that change between only childness and siblingship. And I know that you as a sibling have never experienced only childness, but through your research or your book, I would love to know more about that and the approach to meaning.
Yeah, I think it was interesting because I talked to a few people, quite a few people who lost their only sibling, and they struggled a lot with people thinking that they are an only child when they are not an only child. And, you know, again, I'm not an only child. I didn't interview only children for the book. But obviously it's going to be different, right? Like, because we spend so much time with this person in childhood, it's going to be different. And so people were very distressed when they were misidentified as only children, not because there's anything wrong with being an only child, but because you spend so much time with this person, your identity is often formed in relation to this person. And
there's a sense of erasure there.
Yes, exactly. There is a feeling like this person is being erased and this person is a part of who I am. And if they're erased, then who I am makes no sense. There's right. There's no foil. There's no, you know, anything. It's not exactly what you're asking, but I have a dear friend who's also an author who is an only child, married to an only child, and they have an only child. So this is like an only child pod, you know, and she called me after reading just the intro to the book and she was sobbing and she was like, I don't even know why I'm upset. I don't have siblings. I don't know anything about siblings. This is so beautiful. Now I wish I had a sibling, you know, like, and it's, there's so much to siblinghood that you can't understand as an only child, just like there's tons about only child that I can't understand as someone right. who had siblings and is raising multiple children. And so I think that they're very, very different experiences. And a lot of people I know, you know, some people would change it and some people wouldn't, but I think it's a lot of it has to do with the relationship with your parents as well. And the stress or non-stress that has, you know, if you've been raised with a sibling, you think you always have that person to help you with your parents. And so I think they're very different things. And it was interesting to me how people who lost their only sibling, the level of distress that they expressed when recounting times when they were mistaken as an only sibling. And I think it's exactly that erasure that you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really powerful because, I mean, it's true. There's no way to understand that experience without having had it on both the sibling and only child side. And I think while having the sibling to serve as a foil brings its own beauties, it brings its own challenges as well. And same thing for being the only child, it brings its own beauties and it brings its own challenges. My last question before we start wrapping up, I think grief is often labeled as a negative feeling, that it is bad. We don't want to do it. And I think there's a lot of feelings that are labeled as negative when in reality, feelings should be neutral, right? Because we can't control how they arise. We can only control how we respond to them. So it's really not fair to call anger or joy good or bad. But when we experience these quote unquote negative emotions, you took, I'll use your words, the hardest thing that's ever happened to you and created something to help other people through one of the hardest things that will ever happen to them. And that was a part of your meaning-making process through all of this. What would you say to someone who is going through that really hard thing, negative feelings, and wants to make meaning out of it?
I think I can only, you know, speak for myself, but I think if kind of like we mentioned in the beginning, I think if someone had told me to make meaning, I would have had a real knee-jerk reaction in the opposite direction.
Yeah.
And so I think that people need to, first and foremost, kind of get there on their own. They need to want to make meaning, or, you know, kind of as we talked about it, like they need to want to find that channel, that way to channel the love, which I think is what making meaning really is, at least in relation to grief. And so I guess I would say for people who want to try to find a way to make meaning, it is to think about, how can I show my love for this person? How can I take the love I have for this person and put it back out into the world? Is it by making beautiful art? Is it by volunteering? You know, it could be doing something that has absolutely nothing to do with the person or their death, and maybe you are the only one who knows why you are doing it. And that's fine, because you're only doing it for you. You don't have to do it for anyone else. But I would say if you are looking to make meaning, then I would find ways to do something that brings you joy, and something where you can put that love back out into the world. And I think that is kind of at its essence what making meaning is all about. And sometimes if you label it as making meaning, it puts a lot of pressure on it, and it puts a lot of weight on it. And you feel like, well, you know, my person was, they're better than this, or they deserve more than I can give, or whatever it is. And so that's why I think, you know, if you kind of take the pressure off a little bit and just say, like, there's any small thing can be meaning making. But it's just how we put that love back out into the world.
That's really, really beautiful. In light of our conversation and all of the things we discussed, is there anything else that you want to put out there that you would like to clarify, return to, or something that maybe we didn't touch on that you're like, we need to talk about this? This is kind of space and time for anything that might be on your heart.
No, I think this has been a wonderful conversation. I really appreciate it. Your questions have been so thoughtful, and I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. My final question to kind of put a little bow on our time spent together, it's just, what is one word to describe how you're feeling right now?
Peaceful.
Can I ask why?
The sun's coming in the window. I see the leaves blowing. My dog is napping next to me. My work day hasn't started yet. So I haven't had the stress of the 9-to-5 kick in yet. I think this conversation has been very, filled with that love and peace. So I feel very, very calm.
I am so glad. Thank you so much for your time, your energy, and for sharing your love of Ben and siblings with us today. I am so grateful. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you all so very much for being here today, and a huge thank you to Annie for sharing her story, her process of writing this book, and the many ways that it impacted her and her family. Of course, any podcast here at Making Meaning, I think, deals in a certain level of vulnerability. Of course, discussing one of the hardest moments of your life begs a certain deeper level of vulnerability, and I really want to honor that Annie took the time and space to go there with us. If
you would like to read Always a Sibling or check out more of Annie's work, you can do so in the video or episode notes down below. If you would like to follow the Cohere Collective, you can do so at the Cohere Collective on just about any social media platform that's out there. If you would like to follow me, you can do so at Lillian Reese Brown on Instagram. If you would like to learn more about the Cohere Collective, head to www.thecoherecollective.com. Cohere is also now expanding our services, so if you are interested in finding and pursuing your purpose, head over to the website and learn even more about the different ways that we can help you do that, that we can help each other do that. That's really what this is about. A huge thank you to Nicole Ostreicher for Making Meanings art and podcast cover. You can find her on Instagram at Nicole O Creates or at Nicole O Design. And a big thank you to Tristan Morgan for Making Meanings theme music. You can find him on Instagram at Tristan Morgan. Right now, I am feeling giddy. One, I am preparing to go on a trip. I am recording this just before the 4th of July holiday, and I have some plans with friends that I am just very stoked for, and so I'm just feeling excited to see them and spend time and do something new and see some new things, and that just makes me feel giddy. And also, my parents just came in, and my dad is being very silly, and that just makes me laugh and feel giddy, too. To get to be a kid with your parents again when you're all adults is a really special thing. Also, I've been thinking about the word giddy a lot. My dear friend and guest on the podcast, Kelly Castle, was discussing this on her social media page the other day, that there is something that giddiness does to us, that it taps into this childlike sense of wonder that lends to joy and happiness, but that excitement can truly be what creates the day-to-day energizing experiences that color our lives. So I've just been thinking a lot about that word in different ways I can tap into that feeling in my life, and I'm really feeling it right now. Thank you all so very much for being here today. And I hope you feel like you are living more coherently. Until next time, love. You don't want to be in the intro?
Hey, I'm introducing Reese Brown.
We'll see if that makes it.